Thank you, George. Just thought I'd make the comment before any of the peanut gallery might. These are not Bronco colors that I am wearing. It is not. As you can tell, I've heard that a few times already this evening. This is rust colored. Burnt sienna. Umber. What's that one in the crayon box? Something umber. Yeah, that's what this is. Not Bronco colors. All right. Now that we got that out of the way. Well, if you guys haven't already, turn to chapter 2 with me, Mark chapter 2. We're going to pick up at verse 23. This week, guys, as I was reading some comments on the Gospel of Mark, someone made the comment that Mark wrote this book, he wrote this Gospel so that he could tell others about Jesus. Now, on first blush, I don't have a problem with that, right? Purpose of all the Gospels is to tell us about Jesus. But I do have to disagree, just to a certain extent, okay? Because I don't think Mark's purpose was to simply tell us about Jesus. He didn't want to just merely tell us the story of Jesus. He wrote this Gospel because he wanted us to know the truth about Jesus. In other words, he wanted us to know Jesus' true identity. As we saw a few weeks ago, Mark, I guess it was about 9 weeks ago now since we began this book, but yeah, about 9 weeks ago in Mark chapter 1 in general, Mark was very clear, wasn't he, about who Jesus is. Mark chapter 1, verse 1, he says, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." That's quite a declaration to begin your book. A few paragraphs later, in verse 11, Mark told us about how God the Father spoke audibly. Remember that? At the baptism, at the Jordan River. And God said, "You are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." We even saw a little later in the chapter, verse 24, how the demons even knew Jesus' identity. They said, "I know who you are, the Holy One of God." In these first two chapters, Mark has told us many, many times, this story I'm telling you about this guy, he was not just an ordinary man. He is the very Son of God. And Mark, even then, doesn't just tell us Jesus' identity. He goes on to tell us the authority that Jesus possessed. Right? We've seen that in these two chapters. Jesus had power and authority over temptation, over Satan and his demons, over disease, over even power and authority to forgive sin, as we've seen. Mark has been showing us that Jesus has all of the power, all of the authority necessary to push back the very effects of the curse of sin in this world. Because that's what Jesus is doing in every one of these things that we have read. Well, tonight, guys, as we pick up at verse 23 of chapter 2, Mark is going to show us another thing over which Jesus has authority. As we are going to see, a little bit of a spoiler, okay? As we're going to see in a moment in verse 28, Jesus is going to declare that he is Lord of the Sabbath. Now, I suspect that does not hit you with the same force that some of the other things he was Lord of, because most of us, right, we're not Orthodox Jews or come from a Jewish background, and us modern Americans might think, well, that doesn't sound like that significant of a title. But guys, in Jesus' day, here we go again. It's got a nice beat to it, but I don't think we can dance to it. Can we, like, kick a box or something? Ivan, does this stuff end up on the recording? This noise? Yeah? As we're going to see in verse 28, guys. Right? Now, that may not seem that impressive to us, but understand that in Jesus' day, when it came to his relationship with the Jewish religious leaders, that title, Lord of the Sabbath, was an absolute declaration of war. We just read it and go, that's interesting. Cool thing Jesus said. But no, that is not the way it was taken by those in that day. Now, what made Jesus' claim to be Lord of the Sabbath something that was so hard for the Jews to accept? Well, we need to remember that the Jews were very, very aware that God Himself created the Sabbath back in Genesis chapter 2, after he created everything in 6 days, right? Genesis 2:2, we read that on the seventh day, God did what? Rested. Exactly. So, the same God that created the world is the same God who created the Sabbath. So for Jesus to say that he was Lord of the Sabbath is to equate himself with who? With God. Absolutely. And all those who heard him say it would have understood that. That he is saying he is the God who created the universe. For that matter, the Jews were also very aware that after God called his people out of Egypt, he took them to Mount Sinai, didn't he? And on Mount Sinai, he gave his people his law. And one of the Ten Commandments was that you will honor and keep the Sabbath. Right? So when Jesus claims to be Lord of the Sabbath, he was claiming to be equal with that God of fire and smoke that terrified the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. So yeah, for Jesus to say, I am the Lord of the Sabbath, meant that he was the creator God and he was the one who led his people out of Egypt, which would absolutely blow their minds. Again, we read it and we go, okay, cool. It would have blown their minds. Either that or they would immediately conclude, that guy is nuts. He is absolutely crazy. These are outlandish, heretical claims of power and authority, and some of them probably dismissed them immediately. In their minds, there's no middle ground here, okay? That is what is at stake with the claim that Jesus is going to make. And tonight, we're going to take a look at two short stories where Jesus asserts his claim to be Lord of the Sabbath. Now, these stories aren't just found in Mark. Okay, they are also found in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. And in Matthew and Luke, both, these two stories we're going to look at tonight are also side by side. So I figure if in all of the Gospels where these appear, they're always next to each other, we're going to look at them both, okay? Because they make the exact same claim. So let's begin by reading the first story. It starts at verse 23, if you want to read with me. And it happened that Jesus was passing through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples began to make their way along while picking the heads of grain. The Pharisees were saying to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and he and his companions became hungry? How he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar the high priest and ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for anyone to eat except the priests, and he also gave it to those who were with him." Jesus said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Now, here we're going to see the overarching truth of this story. The Sabbath, guys, was created by God to be a gift, not a burden. But if we are going to understand what is happening in both of these stories, I think we really need to understand just how fanatical the Jews of Jesus' day were in regards to observing the Sabbath. As I mentioned in Genesis 2, when God defined the original Sabbath, it simply says that God ceased from his work of creation and rested. So, if you want to define what the Sabbath is in the Old Testament, it was simply a day when people ceased their regular work for some physical and spiritual refreshment. Okay? And while the Old Testament certainly does have some rules and regulations, it actually does not give us a lengthy list of things that you cannot do on the Sabbath. It simply tells us that Saturday, the seventh day of each week, was a gift from God for your physical rest, for your rejuvenation of your relationship with Him. But guys, the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees of Jesus' day, they really did not like the flexibility that God had given His people regarding the Sabbath. That really bugged them. So they developed very long, very detailed lists of all the things that you were not allowed to do every Saturday. As a result, you know what they did? They turned the Sabbath from the best day of the week into the worst day of the week. I have a book in my library. Maybe some of you have this book as well. It's by Alfred Edersheim. It's called The Life and Times of Jesus. If you don't have it, I highly recommend it. Okay? In this book, he basically teaches what life was like at the time of Christ. But in the book, he also explains what the Jews taught about the Sabbath from the Talmud. Now, the Talmud was a collection of rules and regulations, basically, but it was written after the time of Christ. But what is written there about the Sabbath is the oral traditions, the oral summary of what was taught in Jesus' time. So it gives us a really good understanding of what life was like when it came to the Sabbath rules that the Pharisees had essentially just bolted on to God's word, and really how absurd they had become. For example, since I want us to understand this, let me share with you a bit. For example, you could not on the Sabbath travel more than 1,999 steps from your house. So, from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, you were required to do what? You had to count your steps. Yeah, if you didn't want to do that, you'd stay home. But if you wanted to go anywhere, guess what you have to do on your day of rest? 1, 2, 3. Wait a minute. Was that 3 or was that 4? Right? You all know what it's like when you start counting a bunch. That's what they were. Now, does that sound like a restful and peaceful day to you? And, by the way, as is often the case with bizarre laws, people found equally bizarre ways to get around them. For instance, the Pharisees, who were the very ones who came up with the 1,999-step rule, said that if you put food on your path before the Sabbath, so you stash some food on this route you knew you were going to have to take, and it was located less than 1,999 steps from your home, then you could stop, eat that food, and that constituted another home from which you could then walk another 1,999 steps. Weird, huh? If you lived in a city, lots of houses near each other, right? If you laid a piece of rope or a plank of wood between homes, then theoretically that extended your home because they were touching. So you didn't need to count your steps when you traveled between those two houses. And there are thousands of little bizarre man-made laws like this in the Talmud that essentially enslaved people. It shackled the people. Did you, in the Talmud, guys, there are 24 chapters just on the Sabbath. Just on the rules they made up for the Sabbath. One ancient rabbi spent 2.5 years in studying just one of those chapters, so that he could fully discern all the minute details of what you could and could not do on the Sabbath. Now, guys, was that God's intention when he instituted a Sabbath day of rest once a week? So that his people might, you know, rest occasionally from their labors, as God had done, take some time to refresh their relationship with him. And yet by the time of Jesus, this is what was happening. The Pharisees said that you could not lift anything heavier than the weight of a dried fig on the Sabbath. Now, I don't know what a dried fig weighs. I've never had a dried fig. I can't imagine they weigh much, right? And that was their rule. If you threw something in the air and then caught it with your other hand, that constituted work and you were in violation of the Sabbath. But if you caught it with the same hand, that was not work. And that was okay. I don't know. It's kind of bizarre. If you were reaching for food, okay, the moment the Sabbath began, right, Friday, sundown, you know what you had to do? You had to drop that food to the floor and you were not allowed to touch it until after the Sabbath was over. On the Sabbath, they said that you were not allowed to have anything on your person that was related to your job, to the work that you did. So, for instance, if you were a tailor, right? You couldn't carry a needle in your pocket because that would be considered work. Nothing, of course, could be bought or sold on the Sabbath. No matter how cold it was, you could not make a fire on the Sabbath. If a candle was lit, you could not blow out the candle because that was work. Chairs could not be used on dirt floors. You might go, what in the world does that mean? Well, if you had a chair on a dirt floor and you pull the chair back to sit in it, you've just made a line in the dirt, haven't you? And that is plowing. And you are now in violation of the Sabbath. Women could not wear jewelry on the Sabbath. Why? Because most jewelry weighs more than the weight of a dried fig, apparently. Okay? Women were not allowed to look in a mirror on the Sabbath, because if they did, they would be tempted to pluck out a gray hair, and then that would be work. You were not allowed to write more than 2 letters on the Sabbath. Now, when I first read that, I thought, well, okay, that one's pretty cool. At least they let you get caught up on your correspondence, you know, on the Sabbath. Until I realized they didn't mean 2 handwritten letters. They meant 2 letters of the alphabet. You could not write more than A and B. Because if you did, you were constructing a word, and that would be work. Absolutely. Tying a knot on the Sabbath. Forbidden. You had to go around all day with your sandals untied. Unless You went to bed with your tied sandals on your feet on Friday night. Then I guess you would be okay. Now, again, does any of that sound to you like the sort of rest and rejuvenation that God intended? And guys, that's just a tiny sampling, okay, of the many rules. And please understand, in case that it wasn't clear, none of those are found in Scripture. None of them. And all of them were oppressive. Those rules sucked the life right out of people. The Sabbath wasn't giving life to people. It was destroying their lives. Now, do you begin to see why the Sabbath had become the most dreaded day of the week? So with that little bit of understanding, let's look more closely at our story. Look, verse 23, one more time. And it happened that Jesus was passing through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples began to make their way along while picking the heads of grain. So, what day does this event take place on? It's real clear, right? It's on the Sabbath. This is the day, if you take Mark's advice, when you stay home and do nothing, right? This is that day. But as you can see in this one verse, Jesus completely ignored all of the Pharisees' man-made oppressive rules. He's walking through a grain field with his disciples on the Sabbath. To do that, I have to believe you would have to walk more than 1,999 steps. It's not like this grain field was outside their door, right? And Jesus didn't, I don't think Jesus was counting. I don't think he cared how many steps over he was. But as verse 24 told us, the Pharisees were right there, weren't they? They're dogging Jesus' every footstep. Think about that. They were violating their own made-up Sabbath rules so they could try to catch Jesus violating their made-up Sabbath rules. It really gets a bit comical if it wasn't so sad. And, of course, aha, they catch him red-handed, don't they? Right? They saw his disciples picking heads of grain, which they considered a severe violation of their Sabbath laws. Now, the fields in those days, I don't know how you picture all this in your head when we read it, but they're laid out in strips, right? And with paths in between them. Understand, there were relatively few what we would call highways between small towns. So when you traveled from one small town to another, inevitably you're going to be going through someone's property. So they would use these walking paths to get through. And most likely the disciples, as they were doing this, they were picking a few heads of wheat or barley, whichever of those is what ripened during this time, probably April, August, or so forth. Now, you might hear that and think, well, the Pharisees might be upset because they're stealing somebody's grain. But actually, no, they weren't. That's not what the Pharisees were upset about. Because in Deuteronomy 23:25, God actually made a wonderful provision for travelers. I love this about the Lord. Listen to what it says. When you enter your neighbor's standing grain, then you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain. Why no sickle, guys? Yeah, because now you're harvesting and you're stealing. You're taking their products. But if you grab a few so you can just pop them in your mouth, God said that is perfectly fine. Obviously, not a whole lot of 7-Elevens, right, in ancient Israel. So if you're hungry in the middle of nowhere, you could just grab a few. It's God's gift to a weary traveler. And by the way, right, it did not matter what day of the week you were traveling, you were allowed to do this. But while God gave His grace, while God gave this provision to hungry travelers, the Pharisees wanted to take it away. Think about that. They claimed that if you took a little grain in your hand on the Sabbath, that was harvesting. And then if you rolled that grain in your hand, you know, to get that hard outer layer off, that was sifting. And if you then blew away all of the rest of that, that broken outer shell from your hand, that was winnowing. And all of these were forms of work, and all of them violated the Sabbath. Now, again, remember, the Bible doesn't say there is anything wrong with eating hand-harvested field grain on any day of the week. The Pharisees made up these rules that was saying it was wrong. Now, I mentioned to you before that this story appears in Matthew and in Luke. Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 8 has this exact story. And there we learn the reason why the disciples were taking a little bit of grain from the field. It says they were hungry. That doesn't surprise any of us, right? They were tired. They're worn out, so they took a little grain so that the Sabbath day would be a day of refreshment, not a day of starvation. But the Pharisees would have rather had the disciples weak and hungry on the Sabbath than to be refreshed with food on the Sabbath. And as you see, guys, this kind of reveals a real core problem here. The Pharisees thought that man-made rules and regulations were more important than who? Than people, right? While Jesus is about to claim that acts of mercy and kindness to others are more important than man-made rules, more important than man-made regulations. Guys, whenever our rituals, whenever our regulations come in conflict with mercy and compassion to people, we're in trouble. Because mercy and compassion should win out every single time. Look again here at how Jesus responds to the Pharisees. Look at verse 25. And Jesus said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and he and his companions became hungry? How he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar the high priest and ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for anyone to eat except the priests, and he also gave it to those who were with him?" Now, I want you to notice here how Jesus begins with the Pharisees. I admit that I kind of grin at this. Maybe unfairly so. I don't know. Maybe it says something bad about me. But he begins by saying, "Have you never read?" Now, guys, you got to understand, that was a dig. That was a bit of ironic disrespect. We might tend to think, oh, well, Jesus never would say something that was, you know, a bit of an insult. Oh yeah, he did. This is one of them. You see, guys, the Pharisees prided themselves on having memorized most of the Old Testament. That would be an accomplishment, okay? So, when Jesus basically implies here that they had not read something, yeah, it was insulting because they were supposed to have it all memorized. And of course, Jesus goes on to remind them of an Old Testament story where David and his companions were hungry. Now, that story is found in 1 Samuel chapter 21. We studied it about a year and a half ago when we were moving through that book. This took place during that time when David was fleeing from King Saul. You might remember, Saul wanted to kill David because he was jealous of David. And so as David and his companions fled for their lives, they came to a place called Nob. It's about a mile and a half north of Jerusalem. And since they had fled in haste, they had no food. They had no provisions. They were tired. They were hungry. And in Nob, David met the priest of that area. The priest's name was Ahimelech. And David asked him for food. And the priest wanted to help. That's great, right? The priest wanted to help, but he didn't have anything to give him. He didn't have any food. But the priest had an idea. The priest remembered that even though he didn't have any common bread, he did have the consecrated holy bread. And so he told David that if the young single men who were with David had also consecrated themselves, in other words, they had kept themselves pure, they had kept themselves from women, then they could also have the holy bread, because the priests who would eat it also had to be consecrated. Now, what exactly is this bread? Holy bread. It's also called the bread of the presence. Well, every Sabbath, 12 loaves of hot bread must have smelled great in the tabernacle, right? They would be baked, and then they were brought into the tabernacle, and they were placed on a golden table in the presence of God. Those loaves symbolized the 12 tribes of Israel and them having fellowship with God, to be with and to eat with God. Just like when we have a meal together, right? That kind of creates a relationship. And so God's people needed to spend time fellowshipping with Him and fellowshipping and strengthening that relationship. But as you also likely know, hot bread does not last a real long time, does it? And so, each Sabbath, new loaves of bread were placed in the tabernacle, and that week-old bread was given to the priests so that they could eat it. Well, this priest, Ahimelech, was a very wise man. He was a compassionate man. So even though the week-old bread was supposed to only go to the priests, no one else, in front of him right now were David and his companions, and they were hungry, and they were weary. So the choice in front of the priest was to save the ceremony and lose some people, or save some people and lose the ceremony. You see that choice there? And of course, that priest knew that the right choice was always to show compassion, to show mercy to someone in need, and set aside the ceremony. Jesus' point here, guys, in reminding them of this story, is that ceremony and rituals and traditions, what we grew up with, what we prefer in church, so many of those things are not more important than showing kindness and mercy and love to people in need. But the Pharisees thought that their rituals were more important than the people. Jesus thought the people were more important than the rituals. The Pharisees thought that you pleased God by keeping a long list of things that you did not do. Whereas Jesus said that you please God by caring for people in need. If David was allowed to violate a God-given tradition to help his men when they were hungry, certainly Jesus and his disciples were allowed to violate an illegitimate man-made tradition, right? Just because he wanted to help his disciples who were hungry. Which, by the way, Jesus sums up very well, of course, in verse 27. Jesus said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath." So basically Jesus is telling the Pharisees to their faces, you got it all backwards. You got it all backwards. God gave us the Sabbath to be a blessing to us. We don't exist to serve the Sabbath. God isn't saying this day of the week is more important than you. That's not what he's saying. The Sabbath was not given to God's people to be a burden. It was given to be a blessing, a gift. And if telling the Pharisees that they had it all backward was a big deal, and it was, oh man, the next was the real bombshell. In verse 28, Jesus said, "So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." Jesus is very clearly telling them here, guys, I am the sovereign ruler of this Sabbath, of this set aside day. I created the Sabbath. And guess what? Since He created the Sabbath, since He is ruler over the Sabbath, He gets to define what we can and cannot do on the Sabbath, right? The Pharisees do not. Guys, do you comprehend? I hope you do. Just how absolutely audacious this was, that what Jesus was doing here. This is huge. Jesus is, have you ever had someone say, well, Jesus never claimed to be God in the Bible? Never. Oh my gosh, that is so wildly inaccurate. Here, right here, Jesus is claiming to be the one who created the Sabbath in Genesis and the one who gave the Sabbath to the Jews in the Ten Commandments. He is the one who defines it. He is the one who controls it. In short, Jesus is claiming to be God. And I have to think that at least a few of the Pharisees passed out right there in the field, man. Again, we might read this and go, oh, interesting story. Oh, no, this was not something like that for them. When they heard Jesus say, the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath, they understood what it meant. But Mark then moves immediately, so does Matthew and Luke, as I mentioned, to another event. Now, this event is going to take place a week later than the event we just read. And it took place, if it took place a week later, guys, what day would it have taken place on? Yeah, the Sabbath. Right. Let's begin reading. Look at verse 1 of chapter 3. Jesus entered again into a synagogue, and a man was there whose hand was withered. So here we're going to see Mark build on the truth that we saw a week before. The Sabbath is the right time to help those in need. So 1 week later, what's Jesus doing? He is teaching in a synagogue. And we're told that there was a man there with a withered hand who was listening to Jesus teach. Now, when Luke tells this story, he lets us know that it was the man's right hand. That's actually significant because most people are right-handed. So if you were right-handed and then later in life your hand began to disfigure and wither, that's a real disability, isn't it? That is a genuinely debilitating injury. We really don't know anything else about the injury other than the Greek word that he uses here that we got translated as withered. It basically describes a dead plant at the end of the growing season. Okay, maybe you have some of those in your front or backyard right now, this time of year, right? They just kind of all flopped over and they're just laying there kind of dead. That's the picture. His hand was shriveled. It was rottenness, curled under like a rotten claw. And I suspect probably pretty painful. Okay, this may not have been a life-threatening need, but it was a severe need, wasn't it? And I think it's safe to assume that the reason that guy was there that day is he wanted Jesus to heal him, right? He's hoping, at least, that Jesus would heal him. Jesus had healed so many other people. And once again, verse 2 tells us that the Pharisees were dogging Jesus' every step to see if he might break their Sabbath rules like the week before. Look at verse 2. They were watching him to see if he would heal him being the man with the withered hand, on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse Jesus. Now, this, you can tell a confrontation's coming, right? That coming confrontation could have been avoided if Jesus had merely reminded this man with the withered hand that it was the Sabbath. And he needed to make an appointment, during Jesus' regular healing days or whatever. He could have done that. Notice Jesus does none of that. He had no interest whatsoever in postponing a life-changing healing to accommodate the life-draining Pharisaical rules about what people could and couldn't do on the Sabbath. And of course, Jesus knew who was watching him, right? Mark describes this here as not some, it was not just some casual observation. It's not like they were blending into the crowd and nobody knew they were there. No, this was an intense scrutiny. They're watching every move he made. They're listening to every word he spoke because they're hoping he slips up. because they want to publicly skewer him with their Sabbath rules. Now, incidentally, there is absolutely nothing in the Old Testament that says you cannot help people on the Sabbath. Not a single word in the Old Testament about that. All it says is, don't do your normal work, take a break. Okay? You can still prepare food for your family, you can visit relatives, do whatever else you want. But as we saw earlier, the Pharisees had this system of rules, severely restricting those things. For instance, in this case, they had medical rules for the Sabbath. I know, right? If someone was injured on the Sabbath, doctors could only provide the bare amount, the bare minimum of medical care to stave off death. That's it. You could just keep the person this side of death for the next 24 hours. They could not provide medical care to improve a person's situation or to encourage healing. If you had a gaping wound, okay, on the Sabbath, all they could do was cover it and apply pressure, but only a light amount of pressure. Yeah. Because then if they applied too much pressure, it would be work. Yeah, absolutely. You couldn't stitch it closed. You couldn't dress it entirely because of that. Now, based on what we have seen in the first two chapters of this gospel, guys, when Jesus healed people, he's healed a lot of people, has he not? And we've seen quite a few of them. When he healed people, what sort of work was he performing? Now think about it. All he ever did was either speak a word, right? Or touch somebody. That's it. And of course, they were instantly healed. So here's the problem for the Pharisees. It was really hard for them to exactly pin down the sort of work that Jesus was doing in which he would be violating the Sabbath. But they knew that if he improved somebody's medical condition on the Sabbath, at least by their definition, that was work. Ha! We got him. Matter of fact, in Luke chapter 6, verse 8, where the same story is told, we are told that Jesus knew what they were thinking. He knew exactly what they were doing. And Jesus knew that the Pharisees had absolutely no concern for this man with the withered hand. He was just a pawn that they were trying to use to try and catch Jesus. I want you to think about that. These were the men of God of the time of Jesus. And they had no genuine care or compassion for people in pain. So, since he knew exactly what they were thinking, what is Jesus going to do in this predicament? Look at verse 3. Jesus said to the man with the withered hand, "Get up and come forward." And he said to the Pharisees, "Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save a life or to kill?" But they kept silent. Now, please notice, the man with the withered hand is not back there going, me, please call. He's not asking. He hasn't said anything. He hasn't asked for healing. Jesus just calls him out of the crowd. "Hey, I see you back there, the withered hand. Come here. Come up here in front with me." Now, when Matthew tells this story in Matthew chapter 12, he adds a little bit more information about what was happening here. Can I read it to you? Matthew 12, verses 10 through 12. It says, "And a man was there whose hand was withered, and they questioned Jesus, asking, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?'" You see what? See, it wasn't just a guy in the crowd. This was a setup, right? Because they might accuse him. "And Jesus said to them, 'What man is there among you who has a sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, he will not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable then is a man than a sheep? So then it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath.'" So Jesus, I love how he handles these guys, presents them with a hypothetical dilemma. that essentially boils down to how much more valuable is a man's life than a sheep's life? That's not a tough question to deal with, right? Or at least it shouldn't be, right? We eat sheep. That should clear that one up real quick, right? The human life is much more valuable than an animal's life. So, Jesus says, you all probably have saved an animal on the Sabbath. One of your sheep, one of your livestock, and you've all done that. Now, isn't it logical, Jesus is saying, that it's right to save and help people on the Sabbath? He's making a point here, guys, that, believe it or not, is still very important for us today. Pleasing God is not defined by what you don't do. It is defined by going out of your way to help others in need. And at this point, Jesus knew he had them between a rock and a hard place publicly, right? If they answered that the only way that was logical and right was that it was lawful to save a life on the Sabbath, then they just lost their ability to be mad at Jesus for whatever he might happen to do there on that Sabbath day. And since they were trapped, what do? Nothing. So all they could do was say nothing. And look at how Jesus responded to that in verse 5. This hypocritical silence. How does Jesus respond? After looking around at them with anger, grieved at the hardness of their heart, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. Now, notice here that when they refused to answer, Jesus first, he looked at each and every one of the Pharisees. He looked right at them. And it says he did so in anger. I don't know if you were aware of this. This is the only explicit mention in the New Testament of Jesus being angry. Do you not? Now, there were other times when Jesus was angry. For instance, when he cleared the temple at the beginning and the end of his ministry. We know he was angry. But this is the only time where the Bible explicitly says that he was angry. And why was he angry? He was angry because they were more concerned with Jesus violating their rules and their rituals than they were with showing compassion to one of their own who was crippled. But you may have noticed that Jesus wasn't only angry with them. Mark says that he was also grieved at the hardness of their hearts. That Greek word for hardness there was used to describe the hardness of marble. Their hearts were hard, compassionless, brutal, cold, proud. And you can picture Jesus just angrily turning away from them in this moment and turning to that man with the withered hand and simply saying, "Stretch out your hand." He said nothing more. And instantly, the man's hand was restored. Now remember, guys, his hand was withered, right? Looked like a dead plant. It was shriveled and rotten. And then instantly, right there in front of everybody's eyes, it was completely restored. Flesh regrew. It was instantly filled with warmth and softness. Bones that were brittle and twisted were instantly and fully restored. And muscles that had atrophied and died were instantly restored. And you know that that man was standing there going, "Whoa!" Wouldn't you? And so was everybody else as they saw this taking place. As we have seen previously in this book, this right here was a supernatural work on the order of the resurrection. Jesus brought a dead hand to life by just speaking words. Now, guys, if that had been you, if it had been you that just saw Jesus speak new life into a dead and withered hand, do you think that you would be reconsidering all of your objections to Jesus at that point? Seems like a pretty logical thing to do, right? Maybe my Sabbath critiques and criticisms are not all that big a deal. Be good time to reconsider their position, these Pharisees. Sadly, that is not what happened. In Luke chapter 6, verse 11, we're told how the Pharisees responded to this amazing miracle that happened right in front of them. It says, "But they themselves were filled with rage and discussed together what they might do to Jesus." Filled with rage, filled with fury. That word for rage means they were literally out of their minds with anger and hatred. This was a psychotic rage because Jesus dared to heal on the Sabbath right in front of them and in front of everybody else. And so Mark concludes in verse 6, "The Pharisees went out and immediately began conspiring with the Herodians against him as to how they might destroy him." So immediately they begin discussing what they might do in order to get rid of Jesus. And please notice that to begin their evil plans, I think it's okay to call it that, right? They began talking it over with a group called the Herodians. Now understand, guys, the Herodians were not some other religious group, okay? Like the Pharisees or the Sadducees. They were a secular group. Maybe think of them like a political party, okay? Herod the Great was an Idumean king who ruled over Israel at the direction of the Romans. And so Jews, who had no interest in God, who had no interest in the faith of their people, and were very pro-Rome — you might think that every Jew wasn't, no, there were ones who liked Rome — they would attach themselves to the Herodian cause. And the Herodians were committed to the secularization of religious Israel. They wanted to have the Greek-Roman culture and lifestyle dominate Israel. These were the far-left ultra-liberals of their day, okay? To put it in terms that we can understand. But you might remember, especially from what we talked about last week about the Pharisees were the ultra-far-right conservatives of the day. So what brought together the most liberal, non-religious group and the most conservative, religious group? Their common desire to get rid of Jesus. The Herodians wanted to get rid of Jesus because just during his ministry thus far, people were turning away from Greek and Roman culture. They were turning back to the Lord. Whereas the Pharisees wanted to get rid of Jesus because he claimed to be the Lord of the Sabbath. They refused to obey their thousands of life-destroying rules about the Sabbath. Guys, think about this. We are just barely three chapters into the Gospel of Mark, and we already see the Pharisees committing to work with the most liberal secularists of the day to murder Jesus. And of course, we all know where this is going to end up, don't we? This is all going to come to a head on a hill called Golgotha at the end of this book. Now, as we close here this evening, I want to put a few bullet points on what we've seen here tonight. First of all, guys, and forgive me if some of this is going to sound like I'm preaching to the choir. Sometimes we as the choir need to be reminded of some things, right? Absolutely. But please never forget that Jesus has all authority. Okay? He even has authority over the Sabbath because he created it. In previous studies in Mark, we've seen that Jesus has authority over demons, right? He has authority over disease. He has authority to forgive sin. And here we see that he has authority over the Sabbath, which had its origin in creation itself. Guys, don't ever let someone tell you that Jesus never claimed to be God. That he was just another prophet, just another good dude wandering around 2,000 years ago. It is absolutely not the case. Jesus is the one who created the world. He is the one who created the Sabbath. And since he created it, he has the authority to define it, right? And to redefine it, which is exactly what he does in the book of Acts, doesn't he? With the forming of the new church that God, would be the body of Jesus Christ. Once the church is established, you never read about them observing the Sabbath again, because that was now all completed in Jesus Christ. A second thing I'd like you to take from what we've seen here tonight, guys, and I suspect you get this because I've mentioned it several times, but we live our faith, guys, by displaying compassion toward those in need. I mention this because it is really easy in America today to be pretty insulated from what we don't want to deal with. Okay, whether it's somebody on the street begging or somebody at your door asking for things or even a brother or sister in Christ who are in need. Okay, we live our faith by being kind and compassionate to those in need. We do not live our faith by our flawless observation of religious practices. Now, please understand, I'm not talking about the things the Bible explicitly condemns. You notice that's not what we're dealing with here tonight. This is not, oh, well, Jesus doesn't really care. Just go ahead and sin. Do whatever you want. That's not the point. My point is, religious practices, our traditions, our rules, our preferences, all that stuff is not how we live our faith. In this story of the hungry disciples in the grain fields and the man with the withered hand, Jesus was taking the religious leaders of his day to task, was he not? Why did he do that? Because they cared more about their religious rules than they did about people in need. I love the story of Chuck Smith that illustrates this so well. Chuck Smith, back when Calvary Chapels were just getting started, well, Calvary Chapel was just getting started, and they had this huge influx of hippies, right? These what we maybe today we call them homeless people, you know, the dirty, shoeless. All of a sudden, they're pouring into the church to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ, and there were people in that church who were upset about it. They're not clean. They're not wearing shoes. We just put in new carpet. And they're ruining it. And I love how Chuck Smith responded to them. He didn't say, well, you know, I get your point. Let's take a vote. No, none of that. He simply said, I will tear the carpet out of this church before I make those people leave. You see what he was doing there? It's the same thing Jesus did. Jesus prioritized those who were needy. Chuck Smith was prioritizing those who were needy over preferences, over religious practices. That always trumps the rules. That is a New Testament truth, guys. That is absolutely as necessary today as it was 2,000 years ago. What one last thing, if I can. Please do not forget that God gave us the Sabbath as a blessing to be enjoyed, not a burden to be dreaded. I don't know about you, but this is true of me. I struggle with this. When we think of taking a Sabbath rest, I think it's really easy to only think of it as restrictive. Oh, I can't do this. I can't do that. And when we do that, we're starting to fall right into the same line of thinking as the Pharisees, aren't we? Absolutely. But God intended it to be what? A blessing. A gift. Like I said, I wrestle with this a bit. I need a regular reminder that Jesus is my Sabbath. Amen? Jesus is our Sabbath rest. Guys, we no longer have to work to save ourselves from sin in an attempt to earn God's favor. All we have to do is rest by faith in what Jesus has already done to save us from our sin. Amen? We rest from all of the lists, from all of the rules where we were trying to earn God's favor. Because with Jesus, we have God's favor. You have God's favor. All we have to do is rest in Him. Jesus talks about this. Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30. Listen to what He says, guys. You've heard this before. I want you to hear it with all that we've talked about tonight. Come to Me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take My yoke upon you and learn from Me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For My yoke is easy and My burden is light. Guys, you know what that is right there? It's the gospel message. I don't know if you've ever thought of that passage that way, but that's what it is. And since we do not have to earn favor from God anymore, guess what? We are freed to learn from Jesus, to focus on works of compassion and mercy and love to those in need. Amen? Would you pray with me?